Hello, everybody, and welcome to AMAC's first audio podcast. This is Rebecca Weber with the Association of Mature American Citizens, and today we're going to speak with Dana Lash.
Dana Lash is the number one nationally syndicated female talk radio host in the country and hosts her award-winning show, The Dana Show, from Dallas, Texas. She is the author of three books, the national bestseller, Hands Off My Gun, Defeating the Plot to Disarm America, which turned the tide in the gun control debate, Flyover Nation, You Can't Run a Country You've Never Been to, which predicted the sentiment that decided the 2016 election, and her third book is Grace Canceled. Dana appears regularly on Fox News and has provided election analysis for ABC, CNN, and Fox. A Second Amendment advocate for well over a decade, Dana is one of the nation's premier voices for gun rights. We are honored, Dana, to have you with us today. You have been a strong supporter of our Second Amendment rights. If Biden and Harris are elected, how do you think that could impact our Second Amendment rights?
Oh, and well, goodness, first off, thank you so much for having me and for doing everything that you all do and for talking about this. That's the big million-dollar question, at least for a lot of people who don't outsource our self-defense. That I think Biden kind of answered that at one of the rallies, and I won't forget that this was after he won the nomination to be his party's presidential candidate, and he brought on stage Beto O'Rourke, and he said, "This guy's gonna be working with me. He's gonna be my gun czar." And Beto O'Rourke, Robert O'Rourke, as everyone famously remembers, had said that, you know, he is gonna come take everyone's guns. He said he's gonna take your AR-15s, and which is kind of the AR-15 is kind of an avatar for just all semi-automatic firearms. And so I think Joe Biden's kind of already shown where he is on firearm ownership. Kamala Harris has been the same way. They both use the same language and they talk about semi-automatic firearms when they talk about rifles. And so I worry as to what we would be able to have and not have under a Biden administration. But then even more so, you know, if they're able to get Democrats in the Senate too, you could see the end of the legislative filibuster, and you could see them passing all manner of legislation that they want to pass, and there would be little that people could do to stop it other than maybe perhaps nullification by the states, but even then. So he's always been a supporter of abridging the Second Amendment, and so is Kamala Harris, and you know, obviously I don't support that and have spoken out against it. But yes, I mean, when they say when they're going to bring on somebody like Beto O'Rourke to work with them on firearms, he has said repeatedly, yes, he's coming for your guns. So Biden and Harris, yes, they are coming for your guns.
Thank you, Dana. I appreciate that. There's been a shift in the ideology of our youth across America, and they're now favoring, it seems, socialism over capitalism, despite the clear evidence that socialism leads to communism and continue to fail. Why do you think that young people today are embracing this ideology?
Because of what they're hearing from their professors on college campuses and what they're hearing from, I think, some of their teachers in high school. But definitely college campuses is where a lot of this has been taking place, even colleges that are considered to be maybe perhaps a little bit more constitutional or conservative than maybe some other campuses. But we there's this great quote that I like to this topic always makes me think of this quote by Vadi Beauchamp, who has said, you know, we can't keep continuing to send our children to Caesar for their education and be surprised when they come home as Romans. And that's pretty much the same situation as this. And it's because that's the way it's presented in college campuses, and not just that, but also the Marxist principle of critical theory, and then the offshoot of that, critical race theory. So when you have all these kids going through colleges, and which are predominantly left, it's not a surprise that they're walking away thinking that these horrific forms of governing people are legitimate forms of governing people and don't have, millions plus of bodies in their wake. So I mean, ultimately, that's what I think it is. It's the campuses.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I have a college-age daughter, and she actually shared with me yesterday that her college is sharing studies that show greater female representation in political office and more liberal policy would help contribute to an increase in economic gender equality. And she believes, or is being persuaded to believe, that Kamala Harris as VP would provide for the narrowing of the gender wage gap. What would you say to that argument?
And that's a myth. I think that the wage gap is an absolute myth. And this is, I know that this has been discussed, and I think there's been Time Magazine, to their credit, had a piece on this, and I believe that the Wall Street Journal did as well. But it's an absolute myth. One of the studies that they did for this, they were actually looking at, for instance, comparing the salaries of, say, female nail technicians to that of, say, male doctors. There was no logical comparison in some of the studies that they've used to substantiate this talking point. It comes down to women's choices still to this day. And in some instances, you have women who are actually outpacing men in a number of areas, seeking higher education, getting higher paying jobs, particularly in urban areas. There have been a couple of studies that have been done on that that show that women are actually outpacing men in that regard. But the idea that there is some kind of wage gap is a myth, and it comes down to what women choose to do and what they choose to not do in terms of profession, and especially with some of the CEO positions and others, just by nature, women, when you're looking at these jobs and you're looking at the long hours that are involved and the stress that's involved and the travel that is involved, there are more men than there are women who will choose of their own volition to undertake the travel and the long hours and the stress for certain jobs, for certain higher paying jobs, whereas women will not elect to choose those three things to offset the pay, the high pay that they would get for a higher position. And you can't really hold women's choices against them as a negative and then present this false narrative that it is that their choices are a result of some sort of patriarchal suppression, when it's actually women weighing and determining what's going to be best for them and their families. But it still rubs me the wrong way, because I feel like men are so unfairly targeted. I have two boys,
sure.
My oldest son's in college. And so I get particularly irate over this kind of stuff, the idea that there's, you know, this gender pay gap and our men should suffer as a result of this false narrative. There is becoming a gender pay gap, but it's not men outpacing women. It's going to be women outpacing men.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate that. And we see political divisiveness in the country and how it's seeped into the children's schools, and hearing young people especially talking about really believing that America is racist. And so I ask you, how do you think parents and grandparents can play a positive role in educating our children and grandchildren so that they can grow to love America and see all the great promises and opportunities, rather than see themselves as victims of, in a racist America?
No, I think that's a good question. And I've been talking about this quite a bit, actually. And for all of the discussion of white privilege and racism and systemic racism, this all comes from that critical race theory, which is rooted in Marxism. It's Marxist theory. But I would put it like this. I mean, as for the narrative of this is a racist country built on racist foundations, I don't believe that a country that elected a black president and has a woman of color right now on the vice presidential ticket, a country where you had basically half of the male population surrender itself to fate to free the country, to free a subsect of the country during the Civil War. I don't believe that any nation that undergoes anything like that has within it systemic racism. I reject the idea of systemic racism, which is very different from saying that there is racism and racism does exist, and it also doesn't just go one way. But to believe that it is systemic, there's systematic and then there's systemic. And to believe that there is systemic racism is just something I reject, and something that the history of our country and really even just our history, not just in political office, but in action by common citizens across the country, I don't believe it supports that. But in terms of what people can do in order to focus on the unity and not always subject themselves to these narratives of victimhood, as I always, you know, I look at this as a person of faith, and I always say that, you know, our first identity is that of being in the kingdom. And that's how people need to look at it first. If they're not people of faith, they can say, well, I'm an American first, and this is our identity. I don't like the divisive volunteer segregation that people undertake when they all want to box themselves up in these different groups, because that is the opposite of E Pluribus Unum. And that is the basis on which this country was founded, E Pluribus Unum, which these critical theories from Marxism are completely against. And so the way that we practice it in my house is we're children of God first, and that is our identity. In fact, it's the only identity that matters at all whatsoever. And when you look at it in a proper perspective, nothing else matters. And, you know, American second. And
that's good. Really
it. The idea that we are going to elevate certain individuals and declare someone else more redeemable than another person based on factors that they can't control is insane to me. So that's how we approach it in our home.
Very good. Yeah, I think our members would absolutely agree with you there. So again, thank you so much. Wanted to ask you another few questions here, if you have just a few more moments.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think is the single greatest threat to America's freedom today? There are a lot of threats.
Complacency.
Ooh.
Oh,
okay.
Yes. I think complacency is it, because we have so many tools at our disposal to administer and care for and maintain our liberty, and to, I guess, be stewards of this republic and make sure that it remains so for future generations. We're able to participate with civics, local levels, state levels. We're able to participate in our federal government. And we have many ways that we can have an impact. And I think that a lot of times complacency and the idea that if we can't do it, we can outsource it to government. One of the things that I actually, I talk about also on my show frequently is the idea of, for instance, term limits. And this is going to dovetail into my point on this. So I'm actually against term limits because I don't believe in giving up any more of my authority as an American citizen to the government to determine how long people can remain in office. My term limit is my vote. If I want someone out of office, I'm going to vote against them. And I feel as though we become too dependent upon a federal government or state government when we decide to outsource that power that we have and our obligation and responsibility as citizens to the federal government. Or when, you know, we have the ability to go door to door and to phone bank and to reach out and change the hearts and minds of our citizens. And I think the complacency is when we don't take advantage of that. I mean, I realize people want to have free time and they want to spend time with their families as well. But as Jefferson said, I'd rather have too much liberty to attend to than too little. And so that's the double-edged sword of freedom. Freedom is amazing, but freedom must be maintained. And in order to maintain freedom, it does take a lot of work on behalf of the average everyday American citizen. But that's what you get when you have a free country. And sometimes I think people aren't cut out for the responsibility of freedom. And that's unfortunate because this is the wrong country for that.
Yes, that is a great, very, very good point. I love that you think solutions. We can solve these problems, think of the solutions, and then
Absolutely.
Get working on them. That is great.
Absolutely.
Curious what your thoughts are on Nancy Pelosi wants to establish a commission to determine if Trump is fit to be president. Why do you think Pelosi wants to invoke the 25th Amendment? And do you think that this latest tactic will help or hurt Trump's reelection?
No, I think it actually just helps because it looks ridiculous. And first off, for her to invoke the 25th Amendment, I mean, she would have to get Mike Pence to sign off on this. And Vice President Pence is not going to agree to anything like this, nor are any other Republican senators, nor is any Republican in the House. And I dare say there's probably a number of Democrats for whom common sense would kick in, and they would realize how dangerous it would be to do something like this. There's no way she would even, additionally, there's no way that request would even meet the litmus test of what is required for the 25th Amendment to kick in. I think it's only actually been put into effect a couple of times, and I think it was when Reagan was shot, and then I think once when Bush had surgery, and that's it. Trump, I mean, clearly is very capable of making decisions about executing the office of the presidency and undertaking these day-to-day obligations and responsibilities he has as commander in chief. And to make a silly argument like, well, he's on steroids or apparently was for the coronavirus, that may be affecting his judgment. Well, what she was discussing is something that actually is given, it's safe enough to be given to babies to deal with croup. I mean, there are people who deal with, who take that steroid for serious allergies and asthma. So that was a really ridiculous argument. And it makes her look petty and vindictive. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff only works in Trump's favor. It's not a serious request or serious demand from a serious person in office.
I think most Americans see through it as you do. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Biden and Harris have both refused to answer the question as to whether or not they would pack the Supreme Court if elected. And I think Americans deserve to know where they stand on that issue. Why do you think that both Biden and Harris are avoiding answering that question?
Oh, it would be a firestorm of criticism if they did. And they know very well why. And Joe Biden's talked about this before, although his surrogates now are starting to intimate that, oh, well, maybe he really wouldn't do that. And when they're talking about packing the Supreme Court, what they're talking about doing is simply expanding it and then putting in a number of progressive or far left leaning justices if should they actually obtain power. And this idea that we're going to remove from the legislative body the responsibility to govern the affairs of everyday citizens and give it to black cloth tyranny, which is ultimately what this would lead to, is anti-American, and it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of Democrats who don't support this and have spoken out against it. There are accusations that simply following the president following his constitutional authority and the mandate of the voters to fill vacant seats in the circuit court and elsewhere, for that to be court packing was an abuse of the term. And I really wonder if people understand what they're even talking about when they write about these or when they write these articles and accuse the Trump administration of doing that, for just filling vacant seats. But no, they, to answer your question, they're not going to say, they won't. They're not going to say anything about it because it would be an absolute firestorm of criticism. And that's not something they want when we're this many days out from the election.
Thank you, Dana. I have two more questions. Sure. Who do you think will win the 2020 presidential election? And do you think it's going to be a close election?
I do think that Trump is going to win the election. As to whether or not it's a close election, I tend to think that the closer we get, maybe the better idea that we get of polls. Now, in 2016, polling was ridiculous, and I think it was purposefully so, as a way to encourage the vote with some ideologies and suppress it with others. But in midterms, it was pretty accurate in some parts of the country. The polling was pretty accurate. I'm very careful as to what I look at. I like to look at enthusiasm, and I like to look at averages and likely voters. And I've been focusing mainly on battleground states. And I think it was in 2016, Hillary Clinton was within like 5 or 6 points. There was a 5 or 6 point spread between her and Trump, and Trump ended up pulling out those victories, and particularly a number of states that have been historically Democrat. And it's shaping up to look the same now. I mean, when you look at, I know that there was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that was released that last week, and it the story was Biden is plus 14 ahead of Trump in the national poll. So I went and I was looking at all of the crosstab data of this poll, and I saw that it was weighted, I think it was something like plus 9 in favor of hardcore Democrats, not just your casual everyday kind of Kennedy Democrat,
right,
but hardcore Democrats. And nearly all of them, according to their information, made up their mind as to who they were going to vote for before the first debate ever happened. And they already knew who they were going to vote for before they were even discussing it with these pollsters. And they didn't say what part of the country that it came from, which is important, because if you're talking to, say, a New Jersey Democrat, that's way different than maybe an Arkansas Democrat. And so it was weighted in favor of Democrats, and it wasn't the most reliable poll. And I think it was only something like maybe 800 people were surveyed, which is not a great indication of where the nation is as a whole. So that was a bad poll that was used to establish a narrative and suppress enthusiasm for Republicans ahead of early voting, which kicked off at least in my state of Texas this week. No, when I look at it, I do think that Trump is going to win. As long as the economy continues making the gains that it's making, I don't see how Trump couldn't win. I think there's only been one instance in the history of the country where on an upturn, the economy was doing well, a Republican president wasn't voted for again back in office. So I do think that he's going to win. As to whether or not it's going to be a close race, I feel as though people are less enthusiastic for Biden in some ways than Hillary, but there were a lot of people who hate voted in 2016.
Yes.
There were a lot of people, a lot of Democrats who had been Democrats all their lives, but they could not tolerate Hillary Clinton. And so their vote for Trump was not so much a vote for Trump, more as it was a hate vote against Hillary Clinton. Now, that's an enthusiasm of a whole different kind. So watching the support of enthusiasm towards Biden as compared to Trump, I do think it'll be close, but I do think he's going to win.
Well, it sure seems like it when you see the crowds that attend his events versus the folks that are turning up for Biden. So let's hope that that is an indicator.
I hope I'm proven wrong on that. I hope I've ever wanted to be proven wrong on that.
Oh, very good. Our final question today, Dana. You are the number one nationally syndicated female talk radio host. You're an independent thought leader. Our members would be curious, how did you develop your own voice and this tremendous following that eventually led to your number one award-winning show? Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Yeah, sure. As crazy as it is, being that I am in talk radio, I don't listen to talk radio, and I never really have ever listened to talk radio. I'm aware of the headlines that talk radio can make and the narratives that it can drive, but I've never really listened to it. And I am a political animal, but I also like entertaining content, and I like to be entertained. And I guess that probably plays into it, because it doesn't sound or maybe follow exactly as other programs may, just because I didn't grow up listening to that and consuming that. So I just try to keep it fun. And I don't like lecturing people. I try to be as informative as possible. And if I can't be as informative as possible on a topic for the audience, I either wait until I am, or I bring on someone who is and have those individuals answer questions that I know that the audience wants answered. But we have fun, because it's very easy to get bogged down into politics, and it can be a very, very stressful industry. Punditry can be very stressful, and I don't want people to feel stressed when they listen to the show. I want it to be fun, because you have to have a happy warrior mindset, especially when you do this day in and day out, because it can take its toll. And by approaching it in the most absurd way as possible and laughing at stuff that deserves to be laughed at, because quite frankly, ridicule is just very underappreciated in this country. And by laughing at the stuff that deserves to be laughed at, I think we understand what's important, but we also don't get so bogged down into the emotions of it that we can keep an eye on why we're all doing this in the first place. You know, why are we even interested in this in the first place? Why do we care about it? Why are we doing what we're doing? So I try to keep it as much as I can lighthearted, although there are days when, you know, definitely you have righteous indignation, but it should be fun too, because people cannot sustain that kind of outrage day in and day out. So they need to be able to have some fun, and you need to be able to have fun with them.
Dana, I've listened to your podcast. I love it. I love the humor. Keep up the great work. You are absolutely changing hearts and minds of Americans, and you're delivering really good, honest information. So important. So this has just been a tremendous honor for me to have this opportunity to speak with you today.
Wow, that was some incredible Amazing. Opportunity. Wasn't that good, Dave?
Yeah, I thought she did a great job. I've always been impressed with Dana. She's, you know, went from head of the NRA to starting her own podcast, and is now one of the top 10 female radio talk show hosts. I believe she's one of the only females that's in the top 10.
I believe so. Yeah. And she was a great spokeswoman for the NRA and just had some great information to share. This was fabulous. Well, I'm excited to invite all of our members to join us back again for our next audio podcast. Until then, God bless.